meeting today, technical questions come up or you run into difficulty, why access David Cotton, and he should be able to solve the technical problem. I certainly want to thank David right off the top. First, he has this Zoom account that can accommodate up to 100 participants simultaneously. So that's what's enabling us to do what we are doing with a virtual meeting. I want to welcome all of you who are participating. I very much appreciate the creativity, and I appreciate your willingness to sort of do something a little bit different. I also want to thank our guest speaker for his willingness to participate in this way. By doing our meeting virtually, we stay faithful to the advice that is currently out there to not be gathering together, certainly not in groups of 10 or more, and preferably not getting together at all. And Scott and I are sort of in a bubble right now. We're down in our little farm in southeast Iowa. We're about 15 miles from civilization in any direction. and that's in Davis County, one county that at this point has still not got any positive test cases for the COVID-19 virus. Doesn't mean it's not here, doesn't mean there isn't the risk, and we made a trip to the grocery store. It was yesterday, and I was wearing gloves and a bandana. It looked like I was there to rob the place, I think. But no one seemed put off by it at all or even suspicious that I was there to rob the place. And interestingly, the shelves where normally there would be toilet paper, there was none. Rest assured, we have an ample supply. And right across the aisle from that, those empty shelves were ample supplies of napkins and Kleenex, boxes of Kleenex. So some people are just purists about what they use to clean themselves after defecating. And if it isn't toilet paper, by gosh, it's really not right. And so we have this run on toilet paper. I heard a comedian the other day talking about going into a grocery store, and his plan was to just run up and grab any particular item and say real loud, "Oh, they still have some," and go toward the register. And he was sure that he would create a stampede on whatever the item was he had picked up and exclaimed about. I want to welcome all of you to this virtual meeting. And since I can pretty much see everybody who's currently participating, I'm aware that we don't have any first timers participating today. But be sure and be thinking of other people that you know who aren't participating or you have not seen at a regular Breakfast Club meeting, and invite them to participate in future meetings. These are certainly unusual circumstances. This is the way we're going to do it for this meeting. And then we will make a subsequent decision about the meeting in May and beyond, sort of as we go along, based on the reality that is unfolding. And if we do this again for our May meeting, we will be able to work out any bugs that were identified in this one, and then move on to a May meeting that would go even more smoothly. We have a very few announcements. First, our board meeting is going to be next Tuesday. We're going to do that virtually as well. And that's at 6:30. We're going to do that next Tuesday on the 7th. One of the important items for that particular meeting will be our board reviewing and approving our IRS Form 990, which is due to be filed, I believe, the 15th of April. Is that right, David Wolfhart? Yes. And so the board has to review that and will on the meeting next Tuesday. Also, I have one announcement to make that I got from Jim Sterba. He indicated to me that I needed to let everyone know that there will be no prime timer activities during the month of April. All of those at this point have been canceled. And then a future decision will be made about any activities of prime timers in the month of May. And I can help by circulating that announcement once it's known, once that decision's been made, I can circulate that to our listserv. In this whole exercise, we were able to identify one person whose email address had been inadvertently omitted or not gotten onto our listserv, and we got that corrected. If you or anyone you're aware of is not getting announcements of our meetings, it is because we've not got your correct email address. And if you'll get that to me or to David Wilfork, we'll make sure that you get on the listserv and into the database, and we'll have the convenience of receiving future announcements in that way. Are there any other announcements that anyone needs to have made? If you have any other announcement you want to have made, you'll need to activate your speaker and speak up. Anyone? Okay. Then with that, I will turn to my partner, Scott Cuccio, to introduce our speaker this morning. Scott?
Good morning, everyone. Ted Corrigan is an interim CEO and general manager with Des Moines Water Works, and he's been with the utility for nearly 30 years. He started his Water Works career in the engineering department, where he spent 10 years, followed by 6 years as director of the water production department, 7 years as director of the water distribution department, and 4 years as chief operating officer before becoming interim CEO. Mr. Corrigan is a civil engineering graduate from Iowa State University, a licensed professional engineer, and holds grade 4 water treatment and grade 4 water distribution operator certifications. Welcome, Ted.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. I appreciate that. I'll have to start by saying a couple of months ago, when Jonathan reached out to me and asked me if I would do this Breakfast Club meeting, I put together pretty typical remarks, you know, history and happenings at Des Moines Water Works and kind of points of interest. And a lot has changed since then. So what I hope to do today is pivot a little bit. And I always like to share a little bit of the history and just kind of who we are. But after a couple of minutes of that, I want to transition into our COVID-19 response and our contagious disease response plan, and just let everyone know kind of what we're doing here at Des Moines Water Works to try to ensure that we have an ongoing supply of safe, clean drinking water. And then touch on just a couple of other things, and then, of course, answer any questions that you might have. But as opposed to everyone just looking at me throughout this, I'm going to try to share my screen here and see if I can get a presentation up. Now, can someone tell me, can you see the PowerPoint slides there?
No, cannot.
Uh-oh.
Let me make you a host. Now try that.
Okay. Share. Oops. Well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that did it, and then it gives us on the side. We're on the side now, and your screen is in the middle.
Ah, perfect. Well, let me start with just a little bit of background about Des Moines Water Works. Des Moines Water Works is an independent municipal utility. We have been an independent municipal utility now for almost exactly 100 years. As of November of 2019, we celebrated our 100th anniversary in that state. The Water Works originally started as a private company in 1871, at a time when Des Moines was starting to experience some pretty significant growth. That private company actually had quite a contentious relationship with the city of Des Moines for about 50 years. And then finally, in 1919, the citizens of the city of Des Moines purchased the waterworks from that private company, and we became one of the first independent municipal utilities in the state. And we exist pretty much in that same form today. We are governed by a board of waterworks trustees. Those trustees have all of the same powers as a city council to create rules, set rates, everything except the ability to levy taxes. They can't do that. We are entirely rate funded, but otherwise they function very much like a city government. Our trustees are appointed by the mayor of the city of Des Moines. They're approved by the city council. They serve 6-year terms, but they can serve multiple terms. And in fact, we do have a couple of board members who are in their second or even third term. The board is the administrative authority. They appoint the general manager, and then the general manager has responsibility to manage the water utility. Des Moines Waterworks has about 210 employees, more on a seasonal basis to maintain our parks. We pump an average of about 45 million gallons of water each day, maximum about 96 million gallons. Our operating budget is just a little south of $50 million each year. We reinvest about $30 million in capital projects back into the system on an annual basis, and we serve about 500,000 customers in Central Iowa, which is fully 1/6 of the population of the state, so fairly significant customer base. This is a map of our service area. As you can see, we serve the majority of 4 counties here in Central Iowa. So we have urban, we have suburban, rural service territories. We serve 6 of the 10 fastest growing cities in the state. And as I said, 500,000 people get their drinking water from Des Moines Waterworks every day. We serve those customers from 3 water treatment plants. And in addition to that, we have more than 50 remote facilities around the metro, and those would include booster stations, pumping stations, wells, river intakes, all of those kind of things across the metro that will allow us to gather, treat, and transport the water we need to serve all those wholesale customers. And we deliver that water through about 1,400 miles of pipe that sort of crisscrosses the metro and allows us to deliver much of that water on a wholesale basis to other communities around the metro. So that is a really quick overview of who we are and what we are, just to kind of give you a sense of the size and scope of what we're doing at Des Moines Waterworks. Given the fact that we do serve such a large population, the fact that we're the largest utility in the state, we don't have another option. We don't have the ability to receive emergency supply from other utilities or borrow resources from other communities. When we started seeing this coronavirus spread across the world, we took note. We became fairly concerned, and we focused on it pretty intently starting right about the beginning of the year for a couple of reasons. One is that while we're a big utility for the state of Iowa, we're pretty moderate in size for considering across the country. We do not have a huge number of operators who can operate and maintain our treatment plants. They're very highly trained, very specialized, licensed by the state, and it's critically important that they remain healthy and are available and able to operate and maintain the treatment plants. For that reason, and because we have supply chain issues and resource issues like everyone else, right after the beginning of the year, we dusted off our contagious disease response plan. That is a plan that was created about 10 years ago in response to H1N1, which was going on around the world at that time. We started taking a look at that plan and what we might need to do to update it. You can see on screen there, it's a four-phase plan. You can see the phases. We'll talk a little bit more about those. But one of the things that we realized as this incident was spreading across the world was that it seemed to be much more contagious than other pandemics, if you will, that we had watched in the past. It seemed to be spreading much more quickly. And so we did take the opportunity in February and early March to update our plan and make some changes in an attempt to get ready for what we thought was definitely going to get here. So the first phase of our plan, what we were doing in January, but especially in February and very early March, was the awareness phase. That's when we were watching events unfold. We were kind of tracking the spread first in China, but then especially in Europe. When we saw it get to Europe and how quickly it spread, it really got our attention. Thankfully, all of that was going on outside the United States, and it gave us the opportunity to update our plan, which we did. And then late in February, very early in March, we started doing a couple of other things under what we call the awareness phase. The first thing we started to do was push out some customer communication, make everyone aware that the water quality is good, the water is safe and will remain safe. The processes that we use to treat the water here in Des Moines are very effective against viruses and bacteria, including the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, and that the water supply is safe and available, and it should remain safe and available. We also started some internal staff communication, letting them know that it looked like this was coming, that we have a plan, they need to familiarize themselves with the plan, prepare themselves, prepare their families, because it was likely going to be a fairly significant impact on Waterworks employees if we got deeper into the plan. It actually didn't take long for us to get deeper into the plan. Very early in March, we started entering what we call the limited contact phase of our plan. That's the second phase. And what we do in that phase, first of all, is we recognize that we have critical employees here. If one of those becomes ill, we don't want that to spread throughout the entire employee group. So we started separating them from each other. Similar things to what everybody else around the community is doing, right? We canceled meetings. We postponed training. We even, our morning work calls, instead of bringing everyone together, we kind of distributed that and handed out work orders individually. Then a little later in the month, we actually started limiting employee contact with the general public. We suspended all in-home customer visits. We closed our office to walk-in customers. And then also at the same time, that was about, well, it was the 17th of March, we suspended collection cuts or terminations of service due to non-payment. We did that for a couple of reasons. One is we have a very large cash-only population in Des Moines, and so those people just physically weren't able to pay their bills. But also because having water availability is a very important part of trying to prevent the spread of this disease. So I think we were one of the first utilities to take that step, but most have followed suit and pretty much around the country now. No one is turning people's water off for non-payment, at least for now. We also held our first ever virtual board meeting, very much like you're going to do, it sounds like, and like we're doing right now. It was a Zoom meeting. One difference there, we did have public access to our board meeting. We published the link and a phone number people could call in, and if they had a question or a comment, they could raise their hand. I love this slide because it shows one of our board members there, Andrea Bolton, sitting in her living room holding her daughter on her lap, doing the utilities business and doing it very effectively, as it turned out. We didn't have a lot of public involvement in that meeting, but it went off without a hitch. We'll be doing more of those here in the coming weeks. So, still in March, a little later in the March, we actually entered what we called the isolation phase of our plan. We've already sort of limited contact between employees and the public and whatnot, but now we're moving into a phase where we actually isolate ourselves from the public. We started stockpiling chemicals and supplies so we wouldn't need to take deliveries. We implemented enhanced cleaning, work from home, which it looks like most of you are doing today, which thank you for that. I think that's critically important to this situation. We also implemented reporting from home. We have a number of employees who work in the field, and normally they come in and pick up a waterworks vehicle and go out to the field. Now they're taking their vehicles home and they're reporting directly so they don't have to come in here. We restricted access to all of our facilities from people like the vending machine guy and the rug guy and the uniform guy and just people who normally come in on a daily basis are not coming in. We relocated some of our critical staff from the operations area where the treatment plant is down to our main office, our 24-hour dispatch, our purchasing, our distribution folks. We moved them all out so we could isolate that treatment plant and just prevent all access in or out. We also implemented return to work restrictions. I think everyone is doing that. It was about spring break time. People were coming back from across the country and some of them from around the world. We restricted their return. And then probably the one thing that we've done that is a little bit unusual is that we sequestered a number of employees, a number of critical staff at our three treatment plants. That sequestration started on the 27th of March. We actually sequestered 21 employees in this initial round across our three treatment plants. Operations and maintenance folks, a few support people, critical staff that we need to ensure are healthy so we can continue to run all three of those treatment plants. We sequestered them for a two-week time period, which is actually going to end tomorrow. Our first 2 weeks is up tomorrow. We'll rotate a new group in. And we provided them with food, lodging, everything that they needed to stay there for that two-week period. We asked them to work 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week. The rest of the time they could do what they want, but they could not leave the facility. So they were literally sort of trapped on an island down there. Knowing that they were going to be there for an extended period of time and wanting to ensure that that was manageable, we did a lot of things to try to improve their life for those 2 weeks. We've done some sequestering before. I myself have stayed at the plant during a flood or something for just a couple of days. And I can tell you the plant is a very loud place. And we just were confident that people would not be able to manage sleeping on a cot in the break room for 2 weeks. So we tried to set up some living arrangements for them. We moved in some temporary laundry facilities because I don't know about anyone else, but I don't think I could get through 2 weeks without doing any laundry. We set up a fairly substantial pantry. We brought in fresh fruits and vegetables and fresh meat and things like that. We did not ask them to eat frozen pizzas and microwave burritos for 2 weeks. We wanted them to be happy and healthy. We really wanted to start off on the right foot because we knew it was going to be a long haul. We set up kind of a social distancing mess hall where they can each go in and have their own table or not be too terribly packed in. And then probably the most important thing that we did was we brought a number of campers on site. As I said, the plant is a very loud place. It's very difficult to sleep there. We thought if they're going to be there for 2 weeks, they were going to need a place to get away and have a little privacy. We had a couple of female employees there who definitely didn't want to bunk up in the break room with 20 other guys. So we brought in these campers and we set them up with power, water, sewer, just gives the folks an opportunity to get away a little bit, a little privacy, have their own shower facilities and that kind of thing. We brought in campers. The intent was that they would share two people to a camper. As it turned out, a couple of folks opted to just sleep in their office on an air mattress, which was their choice. But a handful of people brought in their own camper. And so we have a few people sharing. I think there are four of the campers where they're doubled up or even tripled up, and then four that are individual, and then a few people who have their own. So like I said, we're to the end of the first week or the first two-week period. It started off very positively. Morale was high. They definitely want to get out of there now. They've had enough. They're ready to go. They've had some mechanical challenges, some operational challenges. They're pretty frazzled, to be honest, even with all of those accommodations. But they're healthy and well, and we are confident none of them are infected. And so the next group coming in will come into a clean facility. Hopefully our timing is right and they will all come in well too. And another 2 weeks from now, I'm hoping we're pretty deep into this thing. But anyway, that's what we are doing. I'll just touch on a couple of other things quick and then we can answer any questions about that. Regionalization, that was has been a hot topic here in Des Moines for quite a while. We've been working on a plan to regionalize water production in this Des Moines metro area for about 3 years. It's kind of on hold right now because of all of what's going on. But as I mentioned earlier, we serve more than 20 communities ranging in size from a few hundred to tens of thousands. More than half of the water we produce every day is sold to those wholesale customers. Our board is appointed by the mayor of the city of Des Moines. They are all Des Moines residents. And there's been a long time interest from those other communities in sharing responsibility. They would really like to have a part in the planning and leadership of at least production in Des Moines. So we've been working on that for a long time. Actually, in September of this year, our board made a proposal to the other wholesale customers. That proposal was basically to form a new sort of overarching entity called Central Iowa Water. And Central Iowa would be open to membership of every community in the Des Moines metro area. Conceptually, what we proposed is that Central Iowa would own all of the water produced, regardless of who produced it. By agreement, those producers would sell water only to Central Iowa, and then Central Iowa would sell that water back to everyone, including Des Moines, including West Des Moines, other communities who produce water, would sell all the water back at a unified rate. The board would have responsibility for capital planning and spending, for rate setting, kind of overarching responsibilities there. A lot more detail there, but in the interest of time, the last thing I want to share with you is just a couple comments about our park improvements. Des Moines Waterworks Park is 1,500 acres. It's really busy the last few weeks, I will have to say. There have been a lot of people in the park, which is great, but historically it's just been open space. A number of years ago, there was a thought that we could potentially do more in the park. We actually sponsored a design competition. We had dozens of entries from around the world, in fact, but we had a firm out of Boston who actually was selected to do the master plan. They completed the master plan about 3 years ago, and I'm sure you're aware that some of those facilities have been constructed. We have our new amphitheater and pathways and gardens and parking and a tunnel under Fluor Drive that will connect Gray's Lake and Waterworks Park and will be an outstanding addition, I think, to the park system here in the city of Des Moines. The amphitheater has hosted a number of events. If you haven't had an opportunity to attend one of those, I would strongly encourage it. It's a wonderful place to see a show. And if you want to know more about Des Moines Waterworks, you can certainly consider participating in our Citizens Water Academy, which is an annual opportunity for folks from around the community to come and learn more about the waterworks. So I think I'll stop there and see if anyone has any questions about any of that or anything else related to Des Moines Waterworks.
Hey, Ted, this is Joe Rates. I got a question.
Sure.
So this new regional authority, how will that work? Will they put a value of the waterworks system as, you know, X amount of dollars, Ankeny year of the population, Ankeny year percentage? This is your buy-in. And then, you know, you're going to own going forward as you grow. Obviously, you won't pay more. But because when I first heard the proposal, I was not, you know, hey, Des Moines screwed over enough as it is with the 40%. Properties that aren't taxable, but I like the idea of a buy-in. And now as our infrastructure ages, all these other communities that are growing are participating in repairing Des Moines infrastructure. Is that how it would work?
You know, that's a great question. And the initial proposal is that Des Moines would continue to own all of the infrastructure that it owns, but that there would be an opportunity for purchasing that infrastructure at a point in the future. One of the big challenges we've had with that specific question is that we have funded a lot of improvements over the years with bonding, and because our assets are still today being used as collateral for those bonds, we really can't transfer them or sell them to anyone else. And so what we've proposed is that we would begin this regional governance process, and Des Moines would actually receive rate credits. So there'd be this unified rate, but Des Moines would receive rate credits. Think of it as rent being paid for the use and oversight of all of that infrastructure that the other communities would have the opportunity to participate in the governance of. So we would receive rate credits in recognition of the fact that we actually own most of the infrastructure, and that at a point in the future, they would actually have the opportunity to purchase or buy in. And at that point, there would be a significant cash consideration. Exactly how that would work is a little bit negotiable, whether it's significant ongoing rate credits to the waterworks or whether it's cash in hand. But then that cash would be available to the waterworks to improve our infrastructure and do things here in the city of Des Moines in exchange for sharing responsibility for governance of the utility.
Okay. Other questions? David, go ahead.
Hi, Ted. It's David Wilford. Hey, I have a question. Can you update us on, there was a lawsuit a while ago that the Des Moines Waterworks filed against several counties northwest of here in the upper Raccoon River Basin because you were concerned about farm runoff polluting the Raccoon River to a degree that was concerning to Des Moines Waterworks. Where are you in that lawsuit? What are next steps with the concern that you have? Can you talk about that for a bit?
Absolutely. That lawsuit was actually filed against the drainage districts in three counties in northwest Iowa. Basically, our concern was that the water that was discharging from their tile infrastructure was contaminated, and it was contaminating the river. And so we wanted them to become responsible for improving the water quality that they discharge into the rivers here in the state of Iowa. Basically, our perspective was that discharge, which in some cases was, you know, a 24-inch diameter pipe that discharged millions of gallons of water a day into the river, that was a point source and it should be regulated. It should not be exempted under the agricultural exemption, which is part of the Clean Water Act. What actually ended up happening was that the federal court sent those questions back to the Iowa Supreme Court, and my non-lawyer version of what happened is that the courts decided that the drainage districts did not have the authority to affect the water quality in the water that was being drained off of the land. Drainage districts have very specific authorities that are limited to removing water from the land, and they don't have authority to manage that water in terms of the quantity or the quality. And because they don't have authority, they don't have what is called standing, and so they dismissed the lawsuit. So basically, it just ended. Des Moines Waterworks decided that we would not appeal that particular decision. And so we continue to look for opportunities to work on improve water quality, improve our lot in life, if you will. Frankly, I'm not convinced that we have a lot of opportunity to make big changes at this point in time, given the administration that we have here in Iowa, the administration that we have nationally. I don't think that this is probably an opportune time for us to see any policy change, and we firmly believe it's going to take public policy change to affect any kind of change in water quality. So what we are doing right now is working hard on trying to identify other sources that we can use, other sources of raw water that may be less contaminated than our rivers here in the state.
Thank you.
Ted, question on the Northwest Iowa aquifer. There's been some coverage in the paper about the possibility of selling water to the dry out west, and whether that's a good idea, bad idea. I'd be interested in your perspective on that issue.
Well, I have a strong perspective on that particular issue. You know, Iowa is often considered a water-rich state, and I think that that's true in that, you know, we're not arid. We have a lot of rainfall. We have a lot of rivers. But the water in our aquifers is a finite source. The Jordan Aquifer specifically, which is what they're talking about using, is used by dozens of communities across the state of Iowa, so much so that in some areas of the state, especially around Cedar Rapids and Marion, where they're drawing on the aquifer pretty heavily, the aquifer is starting to recede. We use that aquifer, the same aquifer, the Jordan Sandstone, for what we call aquifer storage and recovery, where we actually put water, treated water, down into the aquifer in the wintertime when we have ample capacity, and we recover it in the summertime when we're peaking. Communities all over the metro, Altoona, West Des Moines, others use that same aquifer for their source on a day in and day out basis. So that particular aquifer is a critically important aquifer for the state of Iowa. The resource is finite. That particular site where they want to withdraw water, while it is near the recharge zone of the aquifer, and they believe it will recharge quickly, I think we have to be incredibly careful about shipping our resources out of state. I don't believe that we can do that without consideration of future impacts, and I personally would be strongly opposed to what they're proposing.
Other questions?
Yeah, this is Joe Rates. I got one more question. So Urbandale, it's my understanding, Urbandale bought a mining pit in Johnston there at Beaver in 3580.
Yes.
They still have any plans to go any further with starting their own waterworks department, or is that just kind of on hold at the moment?
I think that those plans are on hold at the moment. That's a big part of the whole regional discussion and the decision-making process for the wholesale communities, is whether they think they can build their own facilities and produce water more cost-effectively than they can buy it. Urbandale had very strong interest 5 or 6 years ago in building their own plant. They bought those quarries. They bought some property south of the interstate, and they were going to build their treatment plant on the property south of the interstate. They're going to use that quarry as a source. They've kind of put that on hold, but I think they still very much have long-term interest in doing something with those properties and developing their own source. But for now, it's on hold.
Okay. Mark Doherty, did you have?
Yeah, actually it's Neil Fagan. And I was just thinking about the major metro areas in the state are located along rivers. Do they have the same experience with water quality? And do you guys work together in terms of trying to set public policy? Seems like that's a huge part of the state's population.
Yeah, you know, most of the major metropolitan areas are located along rivers. And it's interesting. I do a whole presentation on this, and so I'll try to give you an hour's worth of answer here in like less than a minute. But Des Moines Waterworks is located right at the bottom of the Des Moines Lobe, which is an incredibly flat geologic formation in the center of the state. It's incredibly intensively tile drained. And tile drainage is a big part of our challenge because all of the nutrients and manure and everything that's applied to that land up there finds its way into the surface waters very quickly because all it has to do is go down through 3 or 4 feet of soil and then it's in the tiles and they dump it into the surface waters incredibly quickly. So if you're familiar with the geology, I wish I had a slide that I could pop up and show you, but we are right at the bottom of that funnel and we get all of that water through the Des Moines and the Raccoon Rivers. Even in the state of Iowa, most of the other rivers are not as heavily impacted by tile drainage as the Des Moines and Raccoon in our specific watershed. So most of the other communities do not have as significant a problem with nutrients as we have in Des Moines. Some of the other larger communities, what I call the coastal communities, Davenport, Council Bluffs, they use river sources, but there are not nitrate issues in the Mississippi or the Missouri to the extent that we have them in Des Moines, where we see nitrate concentrations that exceed 20 milligrams per liter in the river, which is double what the drinking water standard is. They rarely, if ever, see concentrations in the rivers above 10. So they don't have those same issues. There are other places in the state where they're starting to have issues, but we have the biggest issue. And frankly, when the lawsuit was filed, most of the other utilities in the state took a giant step backwards and said, wow, let's see how this turns out for Des Moines Water Works. We'll wait and see. And we've been kind of the lone ranger on that deal, frankly, because we are most impacted, and there are reasons why that that's the case.
Jim Hardy, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Ted, thanks for talking to us this morning. You mentioned that the virus is very, I don't know what the word was, but containable or easily manageable for the treatment plant, correct?
Yes, and we can kill it.
So it just leads me to a larger question that's I've always wondered about is our water vulnerable to other threats such as, you know, terrorism and et cetera? Is that something we need to worry about, or would that be too difficult for them to pull off, or some group to pull off?
A couple of sides to that coin. One is because our rivers are so challenging, you know, because we do use surface water, and it can be fairly contaminated, we have a very robust process. So most of the things that terrorists would use, you know, they want people to die right away. And so biological contaminants, our process is very effective at removing those things. We don't have a lot of fear that someone's going to dump something in the river that we can't take out and it's going to make people sick. On the other hand, there are threats, and Jonathan had actually asked me about forever chemicals when we talked a couple months ago. You may have heard in the news about PFOS and PFAS, PFOA, the firefighting foams, the nonstick coatings that are starting to appear in water supplies all over the place. Well, they use that firefighting foam at the Des Moines Airport, and they have contaminated the groundwater in and around the Des Moines Airport property. And that contamination is kind of seeping off the airport property now and finding its way into the Raccoon River, but in extraordinarily low, you know, parts per trillion concentrations. We can't remove that, but that isn't going to make anybody sick or make them, it isn't going to kill anybody when they, you know, the first day they drink it. It's much more of a longer term problem. You know, it's a carcinogen. So there are opportunities for our source waters to be contaminated. I think they're more long-term issues than they are acute issues. We're watching out for those every day. There are new things on the horizon all the time. We'll have to figure out how to treat that if it gets into our water supply, but thankfully at this point it is not. And our daily challenges are mostly with nutrients, things that are the result of land use above us, not terrorism.
Right. And Ted, on a related question, When I was on the Des Moines School Board, our headquarters was in the old central campus building, and we were made aware that there was a contaminant plume below the Dyco plant.
Yes.
And that it was gravitating, frankly, it was gravitating toward central campus. And that's correspondingly very close to your one of your storage places or access places for our Des Moines water. What can you tell us about the Dyco plant contamination?
The contamination at the Dyco site was TCE or trichloroethylene. It's a solvent. It was something very commonly used in industry and still very commonly used. But at the Dyco plant, it appears that they, after they used it and got it all kind of goobered up with oil and things that they were cleaning off of their parts, that they were dumping it on their parking lot to keep the dust down. And they did that for years and years and years. And they contaminated the groundwater in and around their facility, heavily contaminated. In the 1980s, which is before I was here, but Des Moines Water Works drinking water tested positive for TCE. And TCE is a known carcinogen. And so even though it was below the limits and in very low levels, we needed to do something about it. And so we have an infiltration gallery, a system of pipes under the ground along the river. That's actually why Waterworks Park is here, is because of this system of pipes underground that collect shallow groundwater. That system of pipes used to go north of the river and collect water near the Dyco site. Well, in the late 1980s, we just abandoned that section of our collection system that went under the river and towards the Dyco site. More recently, we've abandoned everything that is east of Fluor Drive. And so we're just trying to avoid that plume of contamination. And they are continuing to remediate that. They have groundwater wells that extract water from that area and run the water through an air stripping tower. And just the TCE is very volatile. And so if you expose the water to air, the TCE just kind of boils out of it, if you will. It comes out. So they're continuing to do that on an ongoing basis, and we're avoiding that area. And right now, we don't have any TCE concerns here.
Others with questions? Yeah, Bob? Bob, you'll need to unmute.
Ted, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Yes.
The other day I was driving through Waterworks Park, heading west past the Waterworks offices, and I thought there was an area west of there where there's some new pineapple trees planted. Are new trees being planted all the time in the park that take into account the loss of trees along Fluor Drive?
You know, we are always planting new trees in the park. We're not specifically planting them to offset the trees that were removed along Fluor, but we are always planting. All of the trees, you know, there were a number of trees that we've removed for the construction of the amphitheater and whatnot. A number of those were memorial trees. And all of the folks who were memorialized on the trees that were removed have now been memorialized on the lighted sculpture that is part of the improvements in the park. So that's how we sort of offset the fact that we removed their tree. And honestly, we've had very positive feedback on that. And I'm very happy that folks have been pleased with that exchange. But that being said, we're always planting trees in the park, and we're planting a few here and there. We had a lot of ash trees in the park. And so we, in the mowed areas of the park, I think we had 250 ash trees that we had to remove because of the emerald ash borer. So we're actually in the process of trying to replace those trees with native species, not necessarily crab apples, but that's the planting that you likely have seen.
And on a related topic, Ted, the flowers along Fluor Drive, aptly named, mm-hmm. Has historically been maintained by Des Moines Water Works, and I'd at least heard some talk of questions whether that would be ongoing. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we have for 20 years, believe it or not, it's been 20 years that we have been maintaining the planter beds along Fluor Drive, and our staff takes great pride in that, and they do all the designs and plant all the flowers. It's an enormous job. Now that we have the improvements in the park and the gardens around the amphitheater and things, it was really just more than our staff could manage. We have 7 full-time staff who maintain this 1,500-acre park, in addition to another 1,500 acres out at Maffitt Reservoir and a number of remote facilities and all those planters on Fluor Drive. So this year we actually, for the first time ever, requested proposals from landscape contractors to do the maintenance of the landscape along Fluor Drive. And so they've already started. They were out once already this spring and did all the cleanup and the pruning and cutting back the grasses. We're going to continue to manage that and oversee it. Our staff will continue to do the designs for the annual beds. But we are going to have a contractor who manages all of that and does the actual labor. Another interesting thing that's happening, an exciting thing that's happening on Fluor Drive is as the city rebuilds Fluor Drive and we have to remove all the plantings from all the planters and then replace them, there's going to be a completely new design for all the planters on Fluor Drive. And so we're very excited about that and really looking forward to kind of a reset after 20 years of more kind of the formal garden look that we've had out there with the blocks of barberries and roses and grasses. There's going to be, we're going to transition to a much more natural flowing sort of a planting scheme in those islands for the next 20 years. So you'll have that to look forward to.
Another follow-up question. I got my household insurance renewed just recently, and one of the things that they told me that I could purchase through them was insurance for my water connection from the house to the main that's out in the street.
Right.
And I know that I have gotten communications from an insurance company that reminds me periodically that I don't have insurance for a failure in that connection, and offering to sell me insurance. My question is, would it make more sense, would it be feasible and make more sense for the Des Moines Water Works to use its buying power to buy the insurance and cover everybody in the rate structure rather than have us buy insurance individually or not, and then if we don't deal with the breakage on our own?
That's an interesting question. We have an insurance available on a voluntary basis. We actually have about 80% of our customers who participate in the HomeServe program that provides insurance for water service line breakage and other things. And a little background on that, it's important to understand that in the city of Des Moines, customers own their service line from the water main, which is out in the street and may even be on the other side of the street. But customers own their water service from that water main, wherever it is, all the way into their house. There are some communities, even a few in the metro, where the city owns the water service up to the property line, and then the customer owns from the property line into the house. And so it's important that everybody understand, depending on where you live, which model you are under. But in Des Moines, you own from the water main completely into your house. So if that thing leaks out under the street, that's the homeowner's responsibility. Now, 5, 6, 7 years ago, we had a company come to Des Moines and start offering insurance coverage. The company's name was HomeServe, and they were sending out mailings to everyone in Des Moines offering insurance coverage, but they were only going to cover from the property line into the house. Well, we rarely had a customer with a problem in that area. They were always out in the street or the valve that controls the flow of water, which is usually near the property line. That was the most frequent issue. So we intervened there and we worked with HomeServe to expand their coverage, which was very unusual for them. and to offer it at a very attractive rate if we agreed to bill that for them on people's water bills. And so we agreed to all that, and we created a program that is incredibly cost effective compared to other programs around the country, and it covers everything all the way out to the street. It's a program that is voluntary. People can decide whether they want it or not, but it's a good deal. I've got my parents and my in-laws signed up for that the first day. The people can make their own choices on whether they want to be covered or not. HomeServe also offers a sewer line coverage product that we are not affiliated with, and they're doing that on their own. And you can't have that billed on your water bill. It has to be billed separately. But also a fairly cost-effective option, we believe. I'm not at all familiar, but I have heard that insurance companies are starting to offer that as, you know, a rider on your homeowner's insurance that you can do that. I'm not at all familiar with those, but I would caution anyone who's considering that to make sure that it covers all the way out to the street. Usually it doesn't, but if it does and it's less than $5.50 a month, it's probably a good deal.
Thank you for that. Are there any other questions? Well, Ted, I want to thank you again for your willingness to do this and to address our questions. It made it for a very tailored presentation, because it could be specific to people's interests or curiosity about things. That's been very helpful and very, very educational. And I can tell you from having observed the operation of the waterworks for quite a long time now, certainly more than a quarter of a century, that I've been familiar with your work and the role that you have played. And I have known you to be very knowledgeable about the operation of Des Moines Waterworks and how things happen and getting things to happen. One of those people that every organization needs to have behind the scenes that actually does the work. And I've been aware of your role in that regard for a long time, and you've demonstrated it very, very capably here today. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right, guys, we're going to close out here. I want to mention that we're going to make a decision about how we're going to do May's meeting. It's probably going to be done virtually again, by all expectations from my perspective. Our guest speaker will be Federal Judge Mark Bennett. I've mentioned to him at our previous meetings as a future speaker. He has been unique because he has initiated on his own a program of going to visit people in prison that he sentenced to prison while he was serving on the criminal bench, to interview them and find out, did they feel like they were treated fairly, that he sent them to the right prison, that they are getting rehabilitated appropriately, and then learning from that. And at this point, I understand he has visited around half of everybody, and that's hundreds we're talking about, everybody that he sentenced to federal prison while he was actively on the bench. It should be a fascinating presentation. So we have that to look forward to in May. We have yet to spring on him the surprise that we did with Ted to make the presentation virtually, but I'm confident he'll be receptive to that. In June, we still, of course, are going to be up in the air figuring out what we do, because that normally is the month when we have our scholarship recipients and their families in, and that's a really important meeting and important for all of us to be together so that those families can feel the support of being in that environment and having the support of everyone there. We'll have to, though, make some informed decisions about what we do for the June meeting. Again, there is no July meeting, but at this point we still have on tap the July party on the 18th at John Schmaker's home. We'll have to make decisions day by day, month by month, on what we can and can't do in terms of gathering together. in August. Our speaker is to yet be determined, but we have a number of things to look forward to. I encourage all of you to stay tuned for, number one, information from us on the listserv on how we're going to be meeting and functioning, and also stay informed about what you can do to keep yourself as safe as possible. This is apparently a very easily transmitted disease, and it is unusually lethal. Can't be taken lightly. I'm going to spend some time today, in fact. I've got a sewing machine down here at the farm, and I'm going to make some masks that look a little more like masks than the hold-up bandana that I wore to the grocery store yesterday. With that, we will close out this meeting. Ted, to you, thanks again. We really appreciate it, and we will be in touch soon. Thanks. Stay healthy.